Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioner Clint. Any kind of further diversion? Pass. You does.
May it please the court. Mr. Buckwood is an argument for petitioner. Petitioner is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
With our limited time, I want to concentrate really on two key points. But before I do that, I do want to give the court a little background by way of reminder about this case. This case initially started as a delinquent tax case when an independent school district filed suit and was granted judgment for approximately $68,000 in delinquent taxes on a little over 1,000 acres of property in El Paso County. Property had an adjudged value of a little over $1.1 million. The sheriff conducted a tax force foreclosure sale, and the sheriff accepted cash investments bid of $360, 360. Clint denied the purchaser cash investments request for tax certificates on the property because the giving those tax certificates would have had the effect of extinguishing Clint's statutory and constitutional liens on the property.
But was additional money to be paid? I don't quite understand that.
No, ma'am. At the sale, that $360 was the bid, and the sheriff awarded the property for that amount.
But wouldn't it have been subject to the judgment lien?
No, ma'am. When a tax sale is conducted, you're selling the property.
That's in effect, foreclosure?
Yes, that's a tax foreclosure sale. You're selling it for the taxes. And yes, ma'am.
Well, I read somewhere that the amount of the taxes were tendered to the school district.
Okay. This is in El Paso, you have the Clint School District and their taxes, and their tax office was separate at the time of the delinquent tax judgment, separate from the city office that collected for El Paso County. Clint proceeded, took their judgment, had the sale. Then, in that intervening time, Clint closed their tax office, and the city tax collector collected the taxes on behalf of the county and Clint, for everybody. Cash investments went and said, how much do we owe on the county taxes? Because for reasons that are unclear in the record, the county dismissed out of the delinquent tax suit, even though they had some taxes owing. They went to the county and said, how much do we owe you, county, to release your liens? And the tax collector said, we won't release our liens unless you get Clint to release their liens. Clint would not release their liens because they did not want to extinguish those statutory liens.
But if the amount of the taxes was tendered, even though it was after the sale, would Clint accept the...
Yes, ma'am. If the full amount had been tendered, yeah, I don't think we would have.
And it has not been?
No, ma'am.
Okay.
Cash Investments filed a declaratory judgment action to determine the validity of its title since would not give the tax certificates. The trial court ruled that the sheriff's sale and sheriff's deed to cash investment were void and that no title shall pass. And the El Paso Court of Appeals, on a split decision, reversed in part and reversed and rendered in part. The two points that I want to focus on first is, and what I believe is the determinative issue, and where I believe that the Court of Appeals got a little bit off track, is on the order of sale that the court issued. The court issued an order of sale that very unambiguously identified Clint Independent School District as the only entity which could purchase that property at the tax foreclosure sale for less than the judgment amount. In relevant part, the order of sale stated, none of said property shall be sold to any party other than a taxing unit, which is a party to the suit. Now, not only is this unambiguous, It does not conflict with Section 3350B of the Texas Property Tax Code, which is where I believe the El Paso Court got off track a little bit in their opinion. Because 3350, there are two reasons, I believe, that you don't really even have to look at 3350. Number one is the order of sale stands on its own. But number two, even if you accept Cash Investments' argument that Section 3350 was a restriction on to whom the property may be sold, and that statutory restriction did not include a restriction to third-party purchasers, but was a restriction only on the owner of the property or someone with an interest in the property for purchasing the property for less than the minimum bid. Even if you accept that, you don't really have to look at 3350. 3350 really does nothing more than impose a statutory minimum, a floor. In words, the legislature has said, in order to protect the public purse, the property may not be sold to, in my reading, may not be sold to anyone for less than the minimum bid.
What authority do you have for our interpreting 3350 as providing a floor or a minimum, since that language is not expressly used in the statute?
Well, I think that the just reading the statute, Your Honor, number one, just a clear reading of the statute, that it says that the to whom the property may or may not be sold. And when you read that, that says that it may not be sold to, and if I read it, giving it a construction, which I don't agree with, but I give the construction that Cash Investment urges, that statute says that it's a restriction against selling to the owner or an individual, but not to an individual that was a party to the suit, had an interest, but not to a third party. That's as the legislature says, okay, you may not sell it to that class of persons, but there's nothing, and no issue has been raised. They didn't challenge the court's authority, the trial court's authority, to further restrict the class of persons to whom the property would be sold. And the order of sale very unambiguously stated that Clint was the only person or the only entity to whom the property could be sold for less than the minimum bid.
Let me ask you a question.
Yes,
on that, Mr. Gray, and I'm a little bit confused. Are you saying that a taxing authority that initiates a foreclosure on a tax lien gets the judgment, get an order of sale to the sheriff, that somehow someone can go in, and I'm forget about the statute for a moment, somebody could go in and buy from the sheriff that piece of property, and that automatically extinguishes any the lien of the authority that brought the tax suit?
Yes, sir.
Unlike a regular foreclosure of a lending institution or anybody else, their lien survives to the extent that the whatever's paid at the foreclosure doesn't cover that. I mean, if some individual buys it out of the foreclosure and whatever they pay doesn't satisfy that lien, there's some subject to that occurs here, isn't there?
Well, I may not have been real clear, because you really have, in the statute of the property tax code, there are two liens, and you have personal liability, and then you have your in rem on the property. And I think the lien on the property is extinguished. Otherwise, no one would buy the property. Back up. The property tax code says you can sell the property for one of two amounts, the lesser of these two amounts. One is the taxes due and the other costs associated with the judgment. And that's normally what the delinquent tax attorney finds himself in that situation. But there are some times where the value of the property is less than the total amount of taxes due. And in those instances, when you sell the property for that adjudged value, you have a tax lien up here, you sell the property for this amount. If that purchaser bought the property at the lower adjudged value amount, and then had to turn around and still pay these taxes, you would never, the entity would never be able to sell that property and never be able to get their money. Now, what the law does allow is for them to proceed on that deficiency against the person that's personal liability.
So what this statute really does is, at least from your position, it, the taxing authority doesn't have to personally be there at the foreclosure sale in order to force any independent bidder to bid higher than their tax limit.
That's correct, yes, sir.
And so the sheriff, under this sale, had no authority to allow the property to be sold for less than what implicitly was the bid by the taxing authority.
Yes, and in fact, not only is that, I believe that that's set out fairly clearly in Section 3401 of the Property Tax Code. Chapter 34 of the Property Tax Code is the chapter that deals with both tax sales and tax resales. And this court, in 1942, in Danziger versus State, looked at a pre-codification. The property tax code was codified back right before 1979, I believe it was, and as part of the continual codification process. And Article 7328, which was the predecessor statute to the Section 3401C of the tax code, the Supreme Court in 42 held that it imposed a duty on the sheriff to bid the property for the taxing unit in the amount of the judgment if no other bidder bid that much. Now, the Court of Appeals, in reading their opinion, they said, well, we can distinguish the Danziger case from the case at bar because that was a no-bid case. Unfortunately, that's not a correct reading of Danziger. Danziger was not a no bid. What the court said in Danziger was is that no bid does not mean no bid. That no bid means that if there's no bidder who bids the amount of the judgment against the land, then it's bid off to the sheriff. In other words, if there's no adequate bid, to use my words, if there's no adequate bid, or to use my words, if there's no sufficient bid. Sufficient being defined as enough to satisfy the judgment. Now, when the statute was codified some 40 years later, the language was changed somewhat when it was codified.
Are we looking at a drafting error, essentially?
No, I don't believe so. I think it was just cleaning up the language a little bit because no bidder, since the court said no bidder means no bidder, I think that the drafters of the legislative council just stated that if sufficient bid is not received, meaning the same thing as what the Danziger court said, that if sufficient bid is not received, the officer making the sale shall bid the property off to a taxing unit that is a party, etc. So pre-code you had if no bidder, and with 3401C you said if no sufficient bid, but that's after the Supreme Court said that no bid means no bid that is for that minimum amount.
If we were looking only at 3350B, wouldn't you lose?
No, sir.
Why not?
Well, for several reasons. I think that the most important reason, Judge, is that you don't have to look at 3350B at all.
I'm saying, if that's the only place we look.
Well,
we forget what the judgment says. Don't worry about the conflict if there is one with 34.
Judge, you can't. To have a valid sale, it's based on the judgment, the order, and the statute. But okay,
I understand that's the argument.
Okay. But I will address. I just want to make sure we're clear that I'm not entirely comfortable with the hypothetical. But no, you still don't, because I think that. The main reason is that 3350B was likewise codified when the property tax code came about, and it came from Section 7345.
Yeah, but they added to the suit.
Yes, sir. But if you recall the entire codification process, which we've been doing since the 60s, That, and there's legislative history throughout, particularly in dealing with the property tax code. In these sections of the property tax code, there was no legislative intent to change the meaning of these statutes. Well, and in fact, in my brief under point of error number three, I set that out, that that there was no legislative intent.
That's what I meant by drafting here. Don't you think that, or is it your position that what happened in 3350B was a drafting error when they recodified the statute?
To the extent that someone would now read that language and give it new or different meaning than the predecessor statute, then yes, ma'am, I do. But I believe that they were doing nothing more than cleaning and making it clear, which is oftentimes what in codifying statutes that have been amended over the course of several decades, when you then turn around and codify them, the attempt is not to change the meaning or the intent, but to clean them up.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court. Stephen L. Hughes represents argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. I think Clint's contention in a nutshell is that the sheriff could not legally sell two cash investments for less than the taxes owed in this case. And I think the only way that Clint can prevail in this case is if the minimum bid provision in 3350B applies to cash who is not an owner of the property and who is not a party to the underlying tax.
Isn't this a threshold question whether or not the sheriff conducted the sale in accordance with the order of sale and the judgment?
Yes, Your Honor, that is a factor. And,
if the sheriff did not, then is the sale void?
Your Honor, I think that would be true, but the sheriff did in this case. Let me point out the language in the order of sale that allowed the sheriff to give the bid as he did. The order of sale commanded the sheriff to sell the property to the highest bidder for cash, and then it has three exceptions for when a minimum bid would apply. Those exceptions were to the owner of said property. Number two was to anyone having an interest in the property. And number three was to any party other than a taxing unit, which is a party to the suit. Now, if we use rules of construction and look at these different terms, here we have do not sell to anyone having an interest in the party, yet do not sell to any party other than a taxing unit. We have to give different meanings to those different terms, because if the court intended do not sell to anyone other than a taxing unit, it would have used that term anyone, as it did in the previous clause, do not sell to anyone with an interest in the property.
So it's your position there's an ambiguity then in the order, so the sheriff did comply with it?
Yes, the sheriff did comply with the order.
Who else was a party to the suit?
The parties to the suit would be the taxing unit and the taxpayer.
So that's the owner and the taxpayer. So how can you say there's anybody else? If you're going to give it additional meaning, who else would it be? Nobody else.
Anyone with an interest in the property. There may be like a mortgage holder.
They're not a party to the suit.
Right, right. They would be covered by anyone with an interest therein.
But in the third category.
You're saying the third category has to mean somebody else when it says to any party other than a taxing unit, party to the suit. But nobody else could be a party to the suit except the taxing unit and somebody that owned an interest in the property who are already covered by one and two.
Well, there may be like a mortgage company that was not a party to the suit, and they would be sunk to anyone having an interest therein. So there are differences between those three categories. I think for 3350B to apply in this case, this court will have to rule that the language party to the suit means anyone in the world, or anyone, or a person. Now, what Clint contends is that you must construe 3350B, this phrase, party to the suit, to mean anyone in the world, because that was the legislative intent. And there are four reasons why that is wrong. The first source, of course, for legislative intent is the language of the statute itself. And the language here in 3350B is clear. It says the minimum bid provision applies to anyone having an interest in the party and a party to the suit other than a taxing unit. So that language is clear. And I think it shows the legislative intent. Further, elsewhere in the tax code, the legislature has used that term, party to the suit, to reflect that it means a party to the underlying tax suit. But furthermore, the legislature knew when to make a minimum bid provision universal. In the case of abandoned property, the tax code allowed the taxing unit to seize that property and sell it under a tax warrant. And in that case, the code says in Section 34, it says, when you sell this property, the minimum bid provision applies to everyone, except if you sell to a charitable organization. So the legislature knew when to make a universal application of this minimum bid provision. They didn't do that. There's no similar language in 3350B to make the application universal. And when you have specific classes designated in a statute, as 3350B does, the intent of the legislature is to exclude all others from the application of that statute or the application of the minimum bid provision. And that's what happened here. Now, for legislative intent...
Is it your view that 3350 is mandatory and exclusive, that the order must contain this language and can't contain any other restrictive language?
That is right. That is right, Your Honor. And that is because when you make a provision and apply it only to certain classes, you must necessarily exclude that application to others.
This order doesn't quite say that. It doesn't track the same language. So what's the result of that?
I think there's... What it did, it said the order said an owner and anyone having an interest therein. And, of course, the statute says, well, anyone having an interest in the property. So owner would be included with anyone having an interest therein. So the order is essentially the same as the statute.
What legal authority do you have for your position that the statute is mandatory and exclusive and that the order of sale must track or be in accordance with the statute?
Your Honor, it's the language of the statute itself, which say the order must contain this language, and it's the intent that you have in a statute when it designates a certain class, it necessarily excludes persons outside of that class from its application.
I want to ask you about 3401C.
Yes.
What does sufficient bid mean? What would an insufficient bid be?
It's our position that insufficient bid would be a bid by an owner are a party to the tax suit that did not meet the minimum bid requirement.
In that case, it would just be bid back. Why would it mean the taxing authority? In that case, it's just bid back to the taxing authority.
Right.
Isn't that kind of circular?
You may have instances where you have a taxing authority that was not a party to the suit. They could come bid at the tax sale, but they would have to meet the minimum bid requirement.
Why would the legislature want to prohibit a party from bidding below the judgment or below the market value, and in that circumstance, say it goes back to taxing authority, but then let the world come in and bid $2 for a $2 million piece of property and extinguish the lien? What's the logic behind that?
The purpose of the statute is to prevent the taxpayer or someone having an interest in the property, such as a taxing unit that wasn't a party, from coming in and getting the property for less than the taxes owed.
Or the market value.
Or the market value, that's correct. We don't want a taxpayer coming in and getting the property for less than the taxes owed at the tax sale just because no one else bid on it. And what that does is it protects the taxing unit.
Well, it doesn't get their taxes paid, does it?
Well, and this is a point you brought up earlier, Your Honor, was the taxing unit not only has the lien on the property, it has the right to sell the property and get the money that comes from that sale. The taxing unit also has a personal judgment against the taxpayer. So if there's any deficiency after the sale, the taxing unit can go get the rest of its money from the taxpayer himself.
But why would the legislature want to prohibit a party from bidding under the market value and not also prevent the public from paying $2 for a $2 million piece of property? Why is it in the legislators' best interest to say, well, anybody can come in and bid it off for $2, we don't care, and extinguish the lien?
I think it's because the taxing unit can easily protect itself by attending the sale. If they don't like the amount that the highest bid is, they can go ahead and bid in and have it struck off for the amount of taxes owed or the market value.
But you could do that with the owner. You could prevent the owner from buying it in for too little. by just showing up at the sale.
That's correct. Right.
So why should you have to show up at a sale to a non-owner, but not to a sale to an owner?
Well, I think it's what the legislature is doing is that, well, it's real simple for the taxing agent to show up to the sale and protect the sale.
You wouldn't need 3401C if that were the case, because the sheriff, there's no point in making the sheriff strike it off the taxing authority. They have to show up every time anyway.
I think that's the reason that 3401C and 3350D have to be read in conjunction. And that is that a bid is only insufficient if it doesn't meet the minimum bid provision of 3350B. And that is because if you say that a bid is never sufficient unless it meets the minimum bid provision, well, then 3350B doesn't mean anything. It's mere surplusage. It has no meaning. It shouldn't even be in there. Of course, we have to intend the legislature meant for it to have some meaning.
Assume, if you would, that the taxing unit did make a bid here, and they made a bid for the amount of the taxes owed, and therefore they got the property. What then would they do with the property?
They have the right later to sell the property.
Right. In other words, the taxing units typically are not in the business of holding a whole bunch of property, are they?
That's correct.
They dispose of this property because they don't want to hold it. And when they would turn around and dispose of the property, I take it there wouldn't be any limitations on the amount of bid they could receive.
That's my understanding.
In other words, could they turn around and then sell it after they bid for it at this particular auction sale? Could they turn around and sell it for $360? Because that's the most they could get for it.
That I don't know, Your Honor. I'm not too sure. I do know in your in syntax, in the case out of this court held that it, if they do subsequently sell it for more than the taxes owed, they have to remit the excess back
right.
to the taxpayer.
Yeah,
I don't know what the converse is on that.
Also, let me ask you this. Let's assume that the taxing unit showed up at this particular auction. They saw Cash's bid of, what was it, 360, right?
That's right.
And said, there's no way we're going to let that happen. We're going to bid it at the amount of taxes owed, okay? If they do that, once they bid it for the amount of taxes owed and they, in essence, buy it back for that amount, do they still at that time have the cause of action against the tax debtor?
Your Honor, I'm not sure, but I do not think they would at that point because they have bid in. It's been struck off for that amount.
But if they had sold it for $360, then they would still have a cause of action against the tax debtor for the difference between the amount of taxes owed and the amount that was bid on the property.
That is correct. Any deficiency, they would have a personal action against the tax debtor. Okay. Another reason that 3401, the sufficiency statute, has to be read in conjunction with 3350B, is that if you say in 3401 that a bid is only sufficient when it meets the minimum bid provision, well, then it contravenes the language in the minimum bid statute, 3350B, which limits that provision to three classes. But there's also a procedural problem in this case, not a problem, but it would lead us to that, is here the party stipulated there were no irregularities in the sale except for Clint's contention that the sale had to be for the minimum bid. And this court held in State Mortgage Corporation versus Ludwig, that's 48 Southwest 2nd 950, that the mere insufficiency of a price at a tax sale is not enough to render that sale void. You have to have some procedural irregularity that causes that small price or inadequate price. So only if 3350B applies to Cash Investments, who was not an owner, didn't hold an interest in the property, was not a party to the tax suit, is there some irregularity in the sale that resulted in an average price. And that's why this case is not like Danziger. If you notice in Danziger, there the order of sale did apply a minimum bid to everyone. It said to anyone. That's not in this case. But also, the court in Danziger did not explicitly say, we are not considering the impact of 7345B, which was the predecessor to 3350B, because that was not raised below as an issue. But I think if the court had considered that, they would have had to consider that, well, wait a minute, here the legislature has specifically limited the minimum bid provision. How does that relate to what we are saying no bid is and how we're interpreting that? Because to say you always have to bid the minimum would be in contradiction to 3350. There was stipulated here that there are no irregularities in the sale. 3350B, the minimum bid provision, does not apply to cash by its terms. And we request that the Court of Appeals affirm the judgment of the affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeals, or in the alternative that you're mandated to the Court of Appeals to consider the other issues that were not decided by the court.
Any other questions? Thank you. Court is ready to hear rebuttal.
Yes, we commend the court for taking up this matter. In the face of it, it doesn't look very important, but it is. Obviously, the court recognized that. I love that short instruction. I get to argue it up here every once in a while. It reminds me of Newtonian physics, or at least some parts of it, that for every construction or canon, there's always an equal and opposite construction that you can put on it, and we always end up arguing nice black letter law rules of statutory construction to on both sides. In fact, I witnessed the first arguments today here, and I noticed that we were doing the same thing with construction of contracts and deeds.
Let me ask you this question. Why would the argument that's made by cash not make good sense if, in fact, it turned out that if the taxing authority made a bid on the property for the amount of taxes owed, then later turned around and sold the property, it would no longer have the ability to go against the tax debtor for the deficiency?
Because under the current
structure, under the sale we have here, they could still go after the debtor for the deficiency.
They could go after the, when you say the debtor, they could go after the defunct corporation or somebody who obviously didn't have the money to pay the bill. They do retain. If it's struck off to the taxing entity, they do have the ability to pursue the owner. If that owner can be found, and if there's any assets to be had in that corporation that own the property.
They don't have to credit the amount?
No. They would have to credit the amount.
So that would be net a loss. In other words, they would have given up the right to seek a deficiency to that.
No, they would have gotten the complete amount of taxes and costs due under the circumstances, assuming they were able to collect that.
What about the argument that is made in the respondent's brief that virtually hardly any tax sale is a bid more than either the market value or the amount of the judgment?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
In the respondent's brief, they make the argument that in virtually no sheriff sale is there a bidder who makes a bid for more than the market value or more than the judgment, that the bid is typically less than either of those two things, and the property is struck off to that bidder.
That's simply not true. In fact, school districts, we've got all sorts of taxing units here. And many instances in Harris County, for instance, we'll have maybe 8 or 10 taxing units that will have delinquent taxes on a single piece of property. And in most instances, the vast majority of instances, it is not struck off to a taxing unit. It is bought for more than the taxes and cost due. This is an exceptional situation, not the rule. And if they say that in their brief, they're just simply not correct. What we've got here is really pretty simple. The first point is that what controls is the notice of sale, the order of sale that is that is put out by the court. The language in that notice of sale is consistent with Rhodes, cited in our brief, and consistent with Mills, which is cited in our brief, which are both cases of longstanding that says the order of sale controls. Now, beyond that, what we have here is really very simple. We can cite rules of statutory construction going both ways. But what I believe courts are to do, and I think what the courts normally do, is they look at the entire scheme. They look at what the scheme is intended to accomplish. And they apply common sense construction to what the legislature surely meant in those situations. And in this case, we're talking about a non-substantive provision in a code that respondent is claiming is changing at least 40 years worth of outstanding law.
Any other questions?
If I could, I would like to request the parties to provide a supplemental brief on a very narrow issue, and that is whether or not the taxing authority relinquishes its right to recover from the tax debtor the amount that the taxing authority bids at the sale of this property. I know they didn't do it here. I'm just talking about a hypothetical situation which figures into my analysis about how this is going to be.
Sir.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
That concludes argument in the first call.
We'll take another brief.
All rise.